Hey guys, on this episode of The Break, I get to have my dear friend Vern Yip on as a guest. We've known each other for years, and you know him from Trading Spaces on TLC. Literally, the reason why I got into this career of design and television was because of that very show. Also, you've seen him on Design Star and many, many other shows on HGTV. He's an architect, he's a dad, he's a husband, and he's just an incredible guy. We had a lot of discoveries on this conversation. For as long as I've known him, I didn't realize that we both moved to this country when we were 2 months old. So we grew up with immigrant parents, and the stories that we can share, including what our parents packed us for school lunches. I'm excited for you guys to hear about Vern Yip's journey and how he's built his beautiful life with his beautiful family, and actually a lot of what it took to get there. He really needed to be free and open and honest with himself and who he is in order to build this beautiful life. So without further ado, Vern Yip. Hi, Vern.
Hi, friend. It's been way, way too long.
Like forever. And just before we jumped on here, you and I, like out of the gates, just started cracking up because I told you I didn't remember the last time it was that we saw each other. And you said you remember vividly.
I remember very, very vividly. Do you want me to say?
Hell yeah, I do.
We were at a photo shoot. We were at a photo shoot for a network that we both worked at. And you whispered to me and you said, "Vern, we're the only two brown people here."
And you're probably like, "Great to see you, Tanya." The funny thing is how times have changed, right? Like, thank goodness.
I know. And thank goodness, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, representation is everything. It makes such a difference to see yourself represented if you're a woman, if you're a minority, if you're gay, if you're part of the LGBTQIA plus community. I mean, whatever it is that you are, representation is so important. And it's really nice that things have changed.
It really is, because I remember back in the day when I would be, you know, just starting on HGTV, I would get a lot of emails like through the message boards pre-social media that there'd be a lot of young girls that would be like, "Oh, you know, it's so nice to see someone of the Indian culture, Indian heritage being seen on television. We don't see it that often. Now we see a lot of it," but it felt so good. Like, did you get those kind of comments and emails? Yeah,
I actually still do, because even though things have improved, it's still not awesome, right? We're still really, really hard for greater representation to be seen and to be valued. But yes, I have gotten so many emails. I've gotten so many people stopping me on the street, just sort of saying, "Hey, you know, it made such a difference to me growing up to see, you know, somebody who looked like me on our screens." And that's awesome. That's awesome.
Well, I don't know if you remember this, but a long time ago when I was doing my very, 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 very first television gig ever, which was on ABC Family, and I was doing it with John Gidding, and it was a show called Knock First. We were in Boston and you were doing a home show. So I said, "John, we're going to see Vern Yip." And he's like, "Okay." Because we're only a few years apart, so it's not like this. But I mean, I really, Vern, I'm not trying to kiss your butt or anything, but like, I idolized you and I idolized Trading Spaces. And like, I remember from 4 to 5 p.m. every day, or it was on every day of the week, wasn't it?
It was. Or, it was five days a week.
5 days a week. And I remember, because there was no call waiting and there was no like anything like that, I just told my family and my friends, "Do not call me between 4 and 5 p.m. I'm watching Trading Spaces." So
that is so funny. I think it's remarkable that that show happened, because it was sort of like the OG, right? It was it was the first one in its space, and nobody expected it to be a huge show. Everybody just thought, "Oh, you know, it's a daytime show." And, you know, I never thought it was going to last. In fact, when they presented me with the opportunity to do the show, I said, "No, thank you," because I know people were just like, "What are you just
like, that's good."
But, you know, I had just won this award. I'd won Southeast Designer of the Year, and I got my name in a bunch of magazines and publications. And one of those magazines landed on the desk of the production company that was putting together the first season of Trading Spaces. And, you know, they said, come on down and audition. And I did. And I remember it so vividly. They brought in Ty Pennington and they brought in Frank Bielek, our dear departed friend Frank,
who passed away
so sadly. Yes, and we miss him every day. But they brought in Ty and Frank to audition me. And after the audition, they said, you have the job. And I was like, I don't want the job.
Wait, I have to pause you for a second, because the thing that cracks me up is you in a room with Frank and Ty as like your chemistry test. Like, they're zany, off the wall, crazy, and you're more subdued and, like, you know, forward. And, you know, it just is, it's such a funny combination. And I just love the fact that they knew right away that you were perfect.
Yeah, because they were looking for a wide swath, right? They weren't looking to have people like overlap. They wanted people to be like on different ends. And yes, I was like the architect and the person who was like really into measurements and a 32nd of an inch. And I like needed everything to be drawn out exactly. And, you know, it was really funny because we had great chemistry from the get-go. And I mean, I'm so glad we, you know, ended up doing the show. I thought it would last for, you know, maybe a few episodes. It went for so many seasons.
Oh my gosh. Like your adult, a good chunk of your early adult career, right?
Yeah. Well, it went from daytime to, it just flew like a rocket ship to being a primetime show the next year. Mm-hmm. And it got nominated for all these primetime Emmys. And we were like, all of a sudden, like, you know, I was like this guy who, you know, was just young and just starting. And all of a sudden I'm on the red carpet at the Emmys. And
wow. People like, I will say it did help for me. I was doing my undergrad in business marketing. And then I was such a fan of the show. And I was always wanting to do that more creative side of things. And here I am, full circle, right? So I ended up getting my master's in interior architecture. But full circle, I know you now. I just finished our second season of Battle on the Beach with Ty. And like all of these beautiful people that shaped so much of the direction of where I was going. Like, I know you hear it a lot, but I can't help but tell you truly what an impact you all had on my life. Like, you have no idea. I'm like sitting here telling you face to face just what an impact you had, like, and how much influence you had for my career. So thank you.
That's incredibly sweet. I think we just got super lucky. You know, I remember at the time thinking, what convinced me to finally do the show was I thought to myself, you know, right now, and people forget that this is what it was like, but back in the year 1999, mm-hmm. you know, which sounds just so weird to say, right?
The late 1900s.
Design just sort of belonged to the top rung of the socioeconomic ladder. You know, most mm-hmm. people could not afford to have anything designed in their home. They were expected to buy the sofa with the matching chairs and the coffee table that came with the matching side tables. And the idea of actually expressing your individuality and personality in your space just wasn't feasible. There was a demand for it, a huge demand for it, but it necessitated a lot of money. And so, you know, what convinced me to finally do the show was just sort of thinking to myself, this could be transformative. This could really help a lot of people. I don't know if your parents were like this, but, you know, my parents, they're Chinese immigrants. They both passed.
Before you say any more, yes, I'm pretty sure that's all you have to say. Asian parents, I have Asian parents.
Exactly.
Yes. Say no more.
So, you know, they fled China during the Cultural Revolution, which is when communism came in, and they gave up everything to move to the United States. You know, my mom went from being a child psychiatrist to washing floors at a bank. Wow. And my dad went from being a biochemist to being a busboy at a Marriott. But they made these sacrifices because they so believed in this great country that we live in, that in America, if you have hard work and determination in your blood, if you have an education under your belt, you can do anything. And they're right. You know, I mean, as divisive as things may sometimes be now, you know, I always hope that as Americans, we can rally around this idea that we still live in the land of opportunity. We live in a place where your dreams are possible, right? And in so many places, that's not the case. And I remember them sitting me down and saying, okay, kid, you have two choices in life. You can either be a doctor or you can be a doctor. And I was like, okay.
So A or B.
That's it. Did you have the same thing?
Oh my gosh. You like, I mean, everything you're saying, truly verbatim. I mean, my parents came here with nothing and my dad was sleeping in hallways, you know, waiting. Granted, he came here, he'd gotten a scholarship to go to MIT, but he had no housing. He landed with a few bucks in his pocket, like didn't really know where to go next. I mean, very, very similar. And then the pressure.
Yes.
The pressure to do what in their mind is a job of stature.
Yeah. And also security, you know, because I was always a very creative kid. I'm sure you were too.
Yeah.
They really wanted me to be a doctor. And so I obeyed. I went to the University of Virginia. I was a pre-med student. I studied chemistry. I was, you know, economics. I was, you know, several weeks away from going to med school. I did every spring, summer, and winter break working at the Transmitted and Transfused Viruses Laboratory at the National Institutes
of Health. Good times.
Yeah. Wow. I was working on asymptomatic HIV and hepatitis C. And every day I would walk into work and I would think to myself, why are these walls this horrible shade of yellow? Why do we have to work under fluorescent lighting? It's so unflattering. So my brain was not where it needed to be. And so when I pivoted and, you know, I finally broke down and I was like, I can't do it. I feel like this is the rest of my life and I'm going to make a horrible doctor. They were like, okay.
But how did they said, okay, just like that?
You know, my mom was very cool. She was like, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, I want to be an architect. I've always wanted to be an architect. And she was like, go do it. And so that's how I ended up here in Atlanta, Georgia, where I'm talking to you from today. I ended up going to Georgia Tech and getting my master's in architecture. And I got an MBA at the same time just to make my mother feel better that I wasn't going to have to, you know.
How glad are you, though, that you did that?
So glad. You know, I'm glad I have all that. I'm glad I have the science. I'm glad I have the math. I'm glad I have the business. I mean, as you know, as a designer, you need to have a really well-rounded brain. You need to be able to pull references from all kinds of places, right?
Yes, it is. It is the death of a designer if they can't pull off the business side of it, if they're doing their own business, you know, if they have their own firm. It's crucial.
It is. But I also think that there's a part of it, even if you're not running your own business. I say this to young designers all the time because they always say, you know, what kind of advice do you have? And I always say, you know, get as educated as you possibly can. And that means not just being educated in the arts. That means being educated when it comes to math and science. It means being able to, you know, pull references from literature. It means being up on current events. It means being plugged into the world because you never know where you're going to pull inspiration from. And being an informed citizen is one of the best ways that you can sort of distinguish yourself and really kind of broaden your horizons. And that includes creative horizons.
I want to hear really about that moment that you felt like, or when you may have reflected back and realized, wow, that was a big turning point in my career. What do you think that was? Do you think it was Training Spaces? Do you think it was Design Star? Or maybe there were a few breaks along the way? Or was it when you launched your first line of textiles and wall coverings and really expanded? What do you think it was for you?
You know, I've been really fortunate. I've been really fortunate to have several key breaks in my life. And by the way, great idea for a podcast, Tanya. I love this. I think it's inspiring because I think that's what everybody is trying to figure out. You know, breaks start revealing themselves. They start happening when you commit to being authentic and to pursuing what you want to pursue with vigor and with passion, because otherwise you know, life is really short and it becomes laborious, and people will detect that you're not in it for the right reasons, right?
Right. So, especially now more than ever.
Yeah. So the first time I had a break was really when I had my first job out of school. I got out of graduate school and I got a job as an architecture intern at the biggest firm in the Southeast. I was not doing interior design. And my mom told me a really great piece of advice that I've imparted to my kids. She said, you know, when you go to work, make sure that you're the first person at work in the morning and the last person yes. to leave. And mm-hmm. the head of interior design noticed that my light at my desk was always on, that I was always there and I was always working nose to the grindstone. And she came up to me and she said, I'm super impressed. I'm going to give you a break. I'm going to give you the corporate headquarters for Disney Cruise to design, just as Disney was launching their cruise division. And it was a huge break.
Yes, huge.
Huge, because I wasn't even in the interior design department. I was in the architecture department. So she gave me, as a young intern, she gave me this break. And it changed my life, because from that point forward, I started doing the hours I needed to do to take the NCIDQ, which is the qualification yes. examination for interior designers. Mm-hmm. And from that point forward, I ended up doing both interior design and architecture. The second big break really was in 1999. I went out on my own. In the year 2000, I got named Southeast Designer of the Year. And that was Amazing. A huge break for me, because at the time, there really wasn't the internet. It was really, if you got your name into a printed publication that was distributed, you know, that's right. how people knew it was significant.
Yep.
And that's one of, as I was saying, one of those magazines landed on the desk of the production company that was putting together the first season of Trading Spaces. That show, like we were talking about, took off like a rocket ship. And the New York Times did a profile piece on me, and it was the front cover of their home section, which was huge.
Huge.
I mean, the picture was like the top half of the paper. And I remember my mother's attorney brought her a copy of the New York Times and said, look, he's on the front page of the New York Times. You don't have to worry about him anymore. And she nice. Said, yes, but he's not a doctor.
Yeah. that's so funny.
So, you know, that getting that show was a huge break. And the other significant break in my life happened when I came out, when I decided to fully embrace who I am. And that was in my 30s. It took me till my 30s to come out. And this is probably TMI for your podcast.
Nothing is TMI, nothing. I think whatever you say is going to help somebody. So
I met my husband in the most extraordinary of ways. You know that I'm an animal fanatic. So I was shooting 5 days a week, like oftentimes in a different state. And I grew up with dogs. I always loved dogs, but I didn't feel like I could have dogs based on my schedule. And a really good friend of mine at the time said, look, there's a shelter down the street that is a kill shelter. That means that the amount of time those animals have at that shelter is limited, and afterwards they put them to sleep. He said, whatever option you can give them is going to be better than their alternative. And I thought, okay, that makes sense. So I adopted two dogs that were basically on their last week, and I saw a huge billboard for a company called Wagalot, which is my husband's company. He's one of the first people in the country to start dog daycare boarding and grooming. And he has several locations in Atlanta, and he's really good at it. And so I brought them in there for grooming, and then they pretty much lived at Wagalot Monday through Friday because I was on the road shooting and I would pick them up on the weekends. And he was working the front desk and I was dropping the dogs off. And I thought to myself, I had never dated a man. I had never asked a man out. I had never held the hand of a man. I had never done anything, but I knew deep down inside that I was gay. And I worked up the nerve and I was like, hey, I'm having this party if you want to come.
Your heart must have been pounding through your chest.
Yeah, it was ridiculous, you know, because the thought bubble over my head was like, holy crud, I'm gay. when I saw him. And if you saw my husband, you know, you would know why I said that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Honey, the two of you together.
Well, I don't know, but thank you. So I didn't think he would show up, and he did. He showed up, and we literally moved in together 2 months after that, and have now been together for 17 years, which is insane.
Incredible. I look at your social media, and everything is perfection.
Like, no.
Just perfection. Your designs, your family, your dogs, your house. It's perfection. I mean, your vacation homes. So when are we ever going to see, like, the dirty side of Vern?
You know, like, oh my
the
gosh.
Side that's not perfect all the time.
That is so not true. You know, I mean, I think perfection is like, not worth striving for. It's not worth attaining, because perfection does not equal happiness. And I feel like what I strive for is genuine happiness.
Happiness, what, yes. Yeah.
And what I've learned now that I'm, you know, in my fifth decade, I think I struggled a lot when I was in my 20s and my 30s. I hadn't come out as gay, and I was portraying happiness. You know, I had already, like, started on Trading Spaces, and I was not out, and I hadn't figured it out. And everybody thought that I had the world in the palm of my hand. Everybody thought the world was my, you know, oyster. And I just was not complete. You know, I was not being real. I was not being my genuine self, because for so much of my life, I couldn't figure out why I was different, and I didn't want to be different. I don't think anybody who is part of the LGBTQIA plus community chooses to go down this really arduous path. You know, that being said, I wouldn't change anything. We live in a world that has changed remarkably.
Incredibly.
Incredibly. And so people have to rewind back to, you know, 30 years ago.
Right.
And 30 years ago, the world was a lot less accepting. Society was a lot less accepting. And I did, I, like, you know, we were talking about earlier, my parents gave up so much for us to come to this country. I did not want to disappoint. I needed to be the perfect kid in every way. And the other
what you thought was perfect in their eyes.
Yeah. I just wanted to make them proud. I wanted them to, you know, I wanted to pay them back for giving me this amazing life, this amazing opportunity to live in the U.S., you know? I think you have to also rewind and sort of think about the portrayal of what it meant to be a gay man back then. You know, I couldn't identify with any of it. I'm like a geek. I go to bed early. I go to the gym, but I go to the gym because, you know, I want to be healthy. And the media at the time was portraying a very narrow, stereotypical portrayal of what it meant to be a gay man. And I couldn't identify with it. Now, of course, the portrayals are much broader.
Totally.
And, you know, now that I'm out and I'm part of the community, I understand that the community is just as broad as any other community.
You said something that was key. And I think it's that being genuine and authentic. And that's when you really find your true happiness. And I feel like clearly that's why you have what looks like the picture perfect life, because it's authentically you. This is, you're sharing your vacations with your family, you're sharing birthdays, you're sharing your projects, and it is also beautiful. But I always do a little hashtag on my thing. It's called Design Life. And I always like to say, like, you can design the life that you want. You really just have to focus on it, be authentic, be genuine, be pure, be yourself. And then the outcome can often tend to look like that, you know, like Vern Yip's Instagram page.
No, and that's the thing, you know, I think that's very, very wise what you just said. It takes time to, like, round the corner and to realize that you don't have to do any of this for anybody. This is your life.
Yeah.
This is your time to go around the globe and to really make the most of what it is that you want to do. If you live here in this country, and that's what I was sort of alluding to, you know, in the beginning also, is how fortunate are we to be Americans, to live in this country where we do get to a large extent, determine what happens in our lives and what we do with it and how we work towards a goal. Because I look at situations like these poor girls and women in Afghanistan who don't have a lot of choices, who don't even have access to education. And I just think, man, we're privileged.
So lucky.
I look at my little, 11-year-old girl, and I think she takes for granted that she gets to go to school and she gets to learn and she gets to pick any job that she wants to do. You know, doesn't matter if people think of it as a man's job or a boy's job, you know, she gets to do it. And I'm super grateful for that.
You know, you stay so humble, and I feel like I try to stay humble as well with all the things that we have going on. You know, you're in the media, you're in the public eye, and you've always been so gracious and so humble. And I think that is largely in part for the fact that you don't take things for granted. You know, when you tell the story about your parents and why they left, they were in Hong Kong, right?
Well, they were in China, and then they fled China when the communist came in, and they moved to Hong Kong very briefly. And I was born in Hong Kong, but we moved to the U.S. when I was 2 months old. So,
Fern, that's so crazy. So I came here when I was 2 months old also.
No kidding.
Yes,
I knew that.
I was born in India, and I was 2 months old when I came here. So funny. Isn't that interesting?
That is funny. So do you speak, is it Hindi?
It's Hindi, but no, not very well.
Yeah.
It's a shame. How about you?
So when I try and speak Mandarin in China, people reply back in English, which is
But at least you know they understood you.
Yeah, but it's sort of like, thanks for trying, but
because I don't know about you, but when I came to this country, my parents, they did try to speak to us in Hindi, and for a number of different reasons. This we can always get into another time, but you know, I was like the one of the very, very few non-white kids in my school growing up, so I had dealt with a lot of bullying. So I think at a certain point, I didn't want to speak Hindi. I just didn't want to be any more different anymore.
Yeah.
But I know, like, culturally, our parents want us to fit in. They want us to whatever. But at the same time, I know they regret that I don't speak it. But were your parents speaking to you in Mandarin growing up? Like
Mandarin and Cantonese. Cantonese is the language that is spoken in Hong Kong. Much like you, I was trying so hard to assimilate. I was really in a largely white school district, and it was a great school district, and I made great friends, but I really didn't want to stick out. I wanted to fit in. I didn't, just like I didn't want to be gay, I also, wanted to make sure that people didn't think that I was weird or strange, because, my mom would pack my lunches.
Oh my God, don't even get me started. I know.
Look at my lunch and be like, what is that?
What would she pack? Like, what was a typical one or your most horrifying one?
Well, she would pack, like, there'd be like a little tin of rice, and then there would be like these pickled vegetables, and they're really like pungent, and all like kinds of weird little dumplings and things. And she would pack chopsticks, and my compadres were like unpacking their PBJs and their turkey sandwiches.
Yeah.
And
yep.
I was just like, oh, why can't my lunch look like that?
How did it go over with, and I know I keep going full circle, and I think it's just because of Asian parents, and I keep thinking about like how my upbringing is. How did it go with your parents when you came out to them?
So, I was pretty much raised in a single family household. My dad left when I was 7, and I was pretty much just raised by my mom.
Okay.
And it took me forever to kind of come out. But a year before she died, I came out to her. She was really sick with cancer, and I was doing what they call night duty, where somebody had to be awake in her room at night. And my lovely husband was literally, because my mom lived in McLean, Virginia, where I grew up, and I was shooting mostly in Atlanta at that time. And so he was taking me to the airport almost on a nightly basis. And I was taking the plane like it was a bus.
Oh my gosh.
Back to my mom after shooting to do night duty. And
oh my God.
It's just like any parent. Your parent just wants you to, ultimately, they want your happiness.
Right.
That's what they really want for you.
Right.
And I remember telling her, and she just made it seem like it was so not a big deal. She just wanted to make sure I was happy.
Incredible.
And he, Craig, my husband, came with me to several of her chemo sessions. And I remember one session that he came to, it was the middle of winter, and she was like pretty much bedridden, but she like found the energy to put on her big, thick winter coat. And she said to him, "I need to take you for a walk." And she, this frail, sick woman, she just like found the gusto to take him for a walk around the block in her neighborhood. And she was, I remember, I was like, what's going to happen? But I remember her saying to him, "You better take care of him." And it was incredible, because I really feel like my mom was my best friend until she died. She really was. And I just felt like this was her almost kind of like gift to me. She was just, you know, she like made it happen.
What a wonderful gift, and what a weight off of your shoulders. Like, I'm sure you contemplated back and forth. Should I tell her? I don't know how she's going to handle it. I don't want to put more pressure or stress on her. And then for you to make the decision to move forward, it freed you and it freed her. And I think that's so amazing.
It was really like a huge transformative moment in my life, you know, being able to be fully myself and having my family be accepting. And I realized that, unfortunately, that's not the case for everybody who comes out, you know, as being different from their family, whatever that difference is. It freed me up from a creative standpoint, too. I found that I had infinitely more creativity at my fingertips.
Amazing.
It was so
much. Because you were free.
I was free. That's exactly right. What is so great is that, I mean, look at the two of us. We're two kids. We're immigrants, you know, both, you know, coming to this country when we were 2 months old. And I mean, we're on your podcast talking about our television shows and our amazing projects.
Design careers.
You know, it's phenomenal. And I truly think that's only like possible and feasible in this country that we live in. I will always be forever grateful to be an American. And I know that, you know, like I was saying before, I know that these times are more divisive than maybe when we were growing up. But at the end of the day, I always like have that hope. I have that hope that we can all kind of unite around this idea that we live in a really amazing part of the world, truly.
Yes. Well, I'm forever grateful that you are here with me doing this podcast. I cannot thank you enough. And Vern, is there anything you want to shout out and let people know what's going on in your life and where to find you?
Yeah,
what's coming up? Yeah.
Follow me on social media. I'm on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Vern Yip Designs, where you can see a less than perfect life. Truly.
Whatever. I really meant that in the nicest way.
About things being perfect. I just launched a new fabric and trim collection, working on a brand new wall covering collection. It'll be my second wall covering collection. Just launched some new lighting, launching new kitchen and bath, writing my third book. You know, and raising kids, you know, I'm so lucky. I'm the luckiest guy you've ever met. And in large part, I'm lucky because I've met this wonderful woman, Tanya. I mean, seriously, thank you for being my friend for so many years. We've seen huge evolution in our lives. And I am so grateful to be on this journey with you.
Right back at you. Thank you, Vern. You're the best.
The Break with Tanya Nyack, a Mudhouse Media production.